Why does the New Testament start with Matthew? Go. Why does it start with Matthew? This can be conjecture. You don't have to have the right answer. I don't even know if there is a right answer on this, to be honest with you. But why? Why would you suspect that maybe the New Testament canon begins with Matthew?
There are early church father accounts that Matthew was the first written.
Okay, so maybe chronology. What else? There are some early church fathers that do other ones too, but Matthew was one of the more primary ones. Yes?
It starts with a pretty detailed genealogy.
It does start with a pretty detailed genealogy. Why would that be significant?
To know where Jesus came from.
Yeah, let's deal with both of these really quick. The chronology one, I don't tend to favor, primarily because I'm marking priority, but also because I don't believe they were as concerned about that as we were. And whenever you start divvying out all the chronology and the way in which all this, it doesn't really fit with the rest of the New Testament canon. The rest of the New Testament canon isn't organized chronologically. Acts was not written before Romans. Romans was not written before Galatians or 1 Thessalonians. Matter of fact, you know, depending on who you're talking to, Galatians or 1 Thessalonians is probably the first book we have ever written in the New Testament. I think it was 1 Thessalonians. A lot of people will say Galatians. Bottom line is chronology does not seem to be the driving factor most of the time whenever you're talking with the New Testament canon. Now, one of the things that's convenient is that Revelation probably was the last book written. But it seems to me that theology tends to be driving the organization of the canon. The theological importance is way more significant to the early church fathers than chronology. They're not just going, we better just put them in this place because that's when they were written. Like, no, I mean, matter of fact, even the first four Gospels, even though their narratives are prior to Paul, we know they all were written after mainly all of Paul's ministry, if not concurrent. Some people will argue for that, but I'll argue that I think all of them were written after Paul was dead. Bottom line is, chronology doesn't seem to be the driving force. But why would we take the first four Gospels at least, group them together and put them at the front? I think it has more to do with theology. You got to start with Jesus. It's a very simple principle, but it's an important one. We've got everything about our story starts with Jesus. Paul's epistles mean nothing to me without Jesus. The book of Acts is worthless if Jesus hasn't been something that's gotten this kick-started. So if we are going to ask the question, number one, of why are the first four Gospels first, I would say, theologically, you need to start with Jesus. But then if we're going to go down to the question beneath that, why is Matthew the first one? I think it lands more where Trevor's at. Matthew, more than any other gospel, you will find functions as a really good bridge from the Old Testament to the rest of the New Testament. A fantastic bridge. Matter of fact, let's do this. How many people do we have in here? 16? Three groups of five. Split up, and one group will have six. Split up right now and open up to Matthew 1. So find a group. Don't be shy. Let's do this swiftly. Matthew chapter 1. One, two. I think, am I doing that right? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Yes, I said that right, right? Three groups? I'm not looking for four, I'm looking for three. Okay. Okay, so you guys will be a group, okay? They've got their group and their group, okay? Group one in the back left corner, okay? You guys will take Matthew chapter 1, verse 2 through 6a, the first half of verse 6. That will be your section. I'll tell you what you're going to do with it in a minute. Back far right corner, you're group two. You're going to take the second half of verse B. You'll see in your Bible a distinct shift between the two verses, or between within that verse. Begins with David was the father of Solomon. You'll take 6b through verse 11. And then this group up here, you will take verses 12 through 16. And this is what I want you to do. I want you to use your Logos, your computers, your Bibles, whatever resources you have at your disposal. And I want you to come up with the significant story of the name of the person that you're finding. There's a lot of names. So you're going to need to split it up amongst the six or four or five or six of you, however many you have in each of your group. And I want you to say, okay, the pretty much the significance of this person is this. Some of them will be difficult. Some of them you'll say, I'm not sure. Some of them we don't even have recorded, especially in this last group. And in those, that's what you're going to have to say. But right now, I want you to just use whatever you've got and tell me the significance of the person's story and why they would be included in the genealogy. Fair? Everybody understand? Okay, go. Okay. It doesn't matter if you're finished with all the names. That's not the point of the exercise. I want you to just turn around here, and I want you just to start describing to me, what did you find? Let's start with group one. What were some of the significant things that you found? I don't need you to make sure you may name every single name, but the names you did find that were significant, talk to me about their stories. What was significant? Anybody, just start firing away from group one. Abraham, obviously, because why now? I'm sorry. Yeah, where do we find the significant portions of Abraham's life? There's two key passages for Abraham's life. Do we track those down? I'll give you a hint, they're both in Genesis. That's always a good thing. Genesis chapter 12, the calling, whenever God says, hey, I want you to go somewhere. I've got something on the plate for you. What is it going to be? Just go. We'll talk about it later. I will make you, your descendants and as numerous, well, we'll talk about, well, we won't talk about the numerous as the stars, but I think the translation is a little different. But then what's the next major passage for Abraham? Genesis 15, where the covenant is ratified. The covenant between him and God is sealed with blood, and circumcision shortly follows, etc. Major, because all the promises of God's development of these people into a nation starts with Abraham, which is one of the reasons why in verse 1 it's so theologically significant that Abraham comes after David, because chronologically that makes no sense. But we'll talk about, actually, at the third to last week of class, how the genealogies are significant theologically for understanding the Christological impact of each gospel. We'll talk about that later. Okay, who else? We've said Abraham, and that's it. I mean, surely you looked up more than that during your time there. Adam, what do you got? That's fine.
Boaz,
mm-hmm.
Which is, the father of Obed or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But I also found out that Boaz is also one of the names of the pillars of a temple.
Hmm.
Ruth, great-grandmother of David. Obed, David's grandfather. But Jesse, which is mm-hmm. David's great-grandfather, or not great-grandfather, was also used in Isaiah as messianic prophecies. His name was used.
Mm-hmm.
And then David has no son, but his line will reign forever.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Other names in the first group?
Tamar?
Yeah.
She disguised herself as a prostitute because Judah wouldn't give her another one of his sons
mm-hmm.
to let her have a child, and so she slept with him, and he pronounced death sentence on her, but then later he had to regret it because she had the proof, and he declared her to be more righteous than he was.
That's awesome that her name's in there. Anyway, yeah, that's really strange. Group two, what names did you find?
It starts off with David,
uh-huh.
who is, he's David.
Yes, he is. He's an important fellow.
Yeah. And then from there, it just goes on Solomon.
Mm-hmm.
He was also king, built the temple. Rehoboam is after that, and Rehoboam is responsible for dividing the kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
And then next is like Abijah, he tried to reunite the kingdom. Everybody destroyed calf idols. Asa, he wrote Psalms
mm-hmm.
Along with David. Jehoshaphat, he was king for 25 years and eradicated pagan cults and sent out Levites to teach. Basically, what we saw is that, as you keep going, it's just a lot of kings.
Uh-huh.
And either they did things that were like really good or not so much.
Yeah, and you almost have this kind of back and forth. Evil, good. Evil, good. Evil, good. And he keeps going through until you land on which king?
Jeconiah.
Why is he significant?
We didn't get that far.
Is anybody, well, it even semi tells you in verse 11, but he is the king that takes that in a sense is taken into exile under the Babylonian kingdom. Absolutely. Verse 12. Group 3. What names did you find? You don't get any of the big fun ones like David or Abraham. You get Zerubbabel.
You have the first group of exiles back from Babylon. Mm-hmm. He helped build. He was leader for the build of the second temple.
Yeah, absolutely. He's a big important guy. Who else? Did you notice any of the other names?
Zadok. Mm-hmm. He's a priest.
Yeah, that's a little misleading. Because the first Zadokite priest that we're talking about would have not been this one, but this one would have been in the line of Zadok. So, I mean, you can tell the lineage of what he's connected to, but it wasn't that one. But that's not fair because I didn't tell you that before you did it. Other names on there that are significant.
Eli was the grandfather of Joseph.
Mm-hmm. This Eliezer, if I remember right, I believe he's one of the ones in the Hasmonean dynasty once we get there. He's a bit of a punk. No. No, this is the one that gets squashed by an elephant, if I remember correctly. In one of the Maccabean Wars, he goes and thinks that he's found the elephant with the king on it, so he starts stabbing the underneath side of it, and it falls on him, and it turns out it wasn't even the right one. But nevertheless, he was a noble man because he was fighting for the revolution of the king. Where does this one end? Seriously, that wasn't a trick question. I'm sorry. You can give me the Sunday school answer on this one.
Jesus.
Job well done. Why is Matthew first? What is he doing right off the bat? No, none of the other gospels do this right off the bat. Luke has a genealogy, but it's in chapter 3. What is Matthew doing that is so significant that we need?
He's giving Jesus clout. Kind of.
He's giving Jesus clout? How would he be giving Jesus clout? That's not wrong.
Like he's saying like he's like from royalty, like from David. And like he's Jewish or I don't know.
Yeah, he's giving him a hereditary significance in a sense. He's showing the status because of his lineage. Sure, what else? Why is this significant that Matthew is first? Yeah, what he is doing is he's saying everything that follows in my gospel, technically, really, everything that follows in the New Testament is not isolated. It is not by itself. It is a part of a greater story. And he says, you remember the stories? You remember what we've been looking for? Let's go back to Abraham. And he talks about Abraham. Really, if you want to split this up into three sections, which is why I did this, verses 2 through verses, the first half of verse 6 is the establishment of the kingdom of Israel. You have the promise of Abraham, and it leads through all the different people, the people that are passing down the promise. And the promise comes to fruition whenever David is born. Technically, even though Saul was there, Saul is a guy that, the archetypal king is David. Then what you have in the last half of verse 6 through verse 11 is you see this kingdom that was established is now lost. Exile. We're hitting the major points right now. In the time of Israel, the promise that led to the kingdom that went awry, astray, led to an exile. And the exile, Zerubbabel, I'm glad you guys brought him up, because Zerubbabel was one of the key figures that comes out, and we'll talk about him more in detail over the next couple of weeks. He comes out, and he's one of the key leaders of rebuilding the temple whenever the Persians allow them to go back into their land. The kingdom is starting to be restored. And yet, even though we go through some of the Hasmonean kings, even though we go through some of the Maccabean-related people, the kingdom's not fully established once we hit the first century. It doesn't get fully reestablished or restored until Jesus. So what you have is you have Matthew coming right off the bat and saying, there's a bigger story, and if you do not picture Jesus in the bigger story that's been stretched back all the way to the Garden of Eden, all the way through, even the 400 years of silence, you know that between Malachi, the very last book of the Old Testament, and Matthew, there's 400 years of silence if you don't date Daniel to the second century, where we don't have a prophet from God coming and giving us what is happening, telling us the word from the Lord. And Matthew is not just the first one to speak. He's saying what I am speaking connects us to a greater story. Because if you separate Jesus from the greater story that starts all the way back in the garden, and if you don't know the intertestamental literature, if you don't, you will make Jesus into some really weird looking things. You'll distort him. More than anything, the reason why I'm excited about teaching this class is because I'm hoping that we can try to start correcting some of the distorted pictures of Jesus that are rampant in our churches. And honestly, one of the ways of doing that is just learning the Old Testament better, learning the intertestamental literature. I actually don't find it that stupid for the Catholics to have the Apocrypha as a part of their canonized books. Because what they're trying to do is to make sure that we're not screwing up who Jesus is. Because those books really reveal a lot of the story that if you don't have, you don't understand a lot of why is happening what's happening. As a matter of fact, let's watch one of my favorite distortions of Jesus. Just for fun. Oh, come on. This room's terrible. Even had a funny part. Oh my gosh. Anybody can just quote it. We can just let them. Seriously, it's just, what's the internet problem? Oh my gosh. Okay, well, you get the point, I guess. This class is driving me crazy. Not this class, this classroom. Okay, point is this. We have all these distortions of Jesus. We make him into this weird rule maker that's going around just, you know. One of the things that I find really interesting is the major apologetic issues that people have to deal with, the problem of evil in the world, things like that. 9 times out of 10, they go back to a wrong picture of who God is or who Jesus is. 9 times out of 10. That's why I was trying to tell somebody the other day, well, it was this young kid. This kid was like in third grade. I was doing a Revelation conference up in St. Louis area. And he was asking me about the problem of evil. And I said, man, you know, we just had a tornado rip through Joplin this past May. And I said, and I've been answering this question a lot. I said, and what I've come to realize is that the question of why is just really not a good question because it's impossible to answer it satisfactorily. There's no answer I can give you of why something like this happens that makes you go, oh, okay, sounds good. There is no answer. If you're going to ask the question of why, I'm going to look at you and say, I don't know. So, but what I can tell you is who. If I believe that God is all-powerful and that he is all good and that he is bringing about the purposes of his promises, then I don't have to understand why. I just have to trust who it is that's in control. And that, to me, is always the answer. One of the reasons why people have a problem with evil is because they don't believe who God says he is. I understand that. I get it. But you have to understand that's always the issue. And if we distort Jesus in any way, shape, or form, it will affect other people's lives or other people's areas of their lives. We try to act like that well, a lot of times we get pseudo-intellectual objections to Christianity. But in reality, it's they just don't want to submit to the who. They refuse to embrace it. So my goal, and I think Matthew's goal, is to present clearly who by putting him in the context of the greater story. And that's why we're going to spend the first 3 weeks or so, or actually 4 weeks, on the historical lens. That's what we're doing. The historical lens. We are going to look at the history. We're going to go through a lot of things that may seem somewhat dry. We're going to be going through from the pre-exilic. We're going to do a short class on the pre-exilic period. We'll go through the exile. Then we will go through the Greek Empire, well, the Persian Empire, then the Greek Empire. We'll go through the Hasmonean Dynasty, the Maccabean Revolts, all of that leading up to the first century. And the reason why I'll spend 3 weeks even somewhat risking you guys being bored and falling asleep on me is because if you don't know the greater story, you'll distort Jesus. You won't know who he is. You won't even know why the people are reacting to him the way they're reacting to him. Why is it that they want to hang this guy on a tree? Because at one point, what we will do, we will go through every single non-Christian source, well, really Greco-Roman source, and then we will also dabble in some of the non-canonical gospels. But the accusations they throw at Jesus, it's always accompanied with calling him a miracle worker and with calling him a wise man. So why is he hung on a tree? Well, if you understand the bigger story, you understand. Genealogies are not something we can skip over. They're celebrations of God's movement throughout history beyond all odds. And the reason why I think Matthew was put first is because his content, his theological content, is saying, let's recap. Let's look at the whole story. Remember, Jesus doesn't come out of nowhere. He doesn't just come on the scene. The first one of the Vintage 21 videos is the one whenever Peter's walking around, da-da-da, and he's like, Andrew's like, look, it's Jesus. And he came, he's like, that's a rock. But it's, and then all of a sudden, Jesus just like appears on the scene. That's not the gospel story. Jesus doesn't just come out of nowhere. He has a long line of people that doesn't just give him clout. It does. But it also says, remember where we've been moving for the past several millennium? Remember where we've been moving? Oh, okay. Here comes a really big moment in that. So how do we get connected to the overall big story? Well, first of all, let's ask this question. What do you know, just before even taking the class, before anything, what do you know has shifted between Malachi and Matthew? What has shifted? What is different? When I come into the New Testament world and the Gospels, what is different from where I was in Malachi, right at the end of the Old Testament? Yeah, go ahead.
Well, you're into the Roman Empire, which is completely different than some of the earlier empires that the Old Testament was written
about. Absolutely. You know, the Babylonian and Persian empires are long gone. They've actually not reigned for the last 350 years or so by the time that we have the Gospels coming, the birth of Jesus. Absolutely. Major, major shift in the power of the world. As a matter of fact, the Roman Empire has accomplished something by the time of the Gospels that none of the other ones ever were. They rule more of the world than really any of them. Now, people will say Alexander the Great went and conquered more of the world, and that's true. But he didn't rule most of the world. Conquering is much different than ruling, because ruling indicates that you didn't just win a battle. Ruling indicates that you're maintaining what you have secured. And the Roman Empire is doing it in a way we've never seen before. Other stuff. Okay.
Like, there's still a big rural community, but...
Yeah, really,
centralization.
There is. There definitely is. Yes. Money is still in the rural areas, which is so ironic. Money is not found in the urban areas. You want to make money, you own country land. You own agricultural institutions. That's what you own. But yeah, a lot of cities now have exploded. Although we did see a lot of that with Athens. There's just a lot more of them now. Absolutely. What else?
The Pharisees and Sadducees.
Yeah, where'd they come from? Pharisees and Sadducees are on the scene now. They were not dominant figures in the Old Testament at all. As a matter of fact, we'll talk about that I think that they both, or actually three groups in a sense, will emerge at around the same time, around the middle of the second century. Yep. Absolutely. We're in the Herodian temple at this point. Synagogues are a major deal, and they were not in the Old Testament. Absolutely. Other stuff? What about theologically? What's developed over the last 400 years theologically? One of the things, what we may not get to today, we'll get to it tomorrow, is the whole concept of really angels and demons really becomes quite prominent in the intertestamental period. They don't play as big of a figure. They make appearances, primarily angels. They make appearances of the Old Testament. But an angelology really isn't fully, more fully developed until the intertestamental period, as well as the concept of a resurrection. We get hints of a resurrection throughout the Old Testament, Daniel 12, some passages in Psalms, although when you're dealing with poetic literature, I don't know how much you can say a theological, you know, element is being developed. But we have 2 Maccabees 7, which we'll read sometime today or tomorrow. They literally die saying, because I trust I will be resurrected. A resurrection's really become a key point of Judaism by the time of the first century. A general resurrection. And that's a major difference between a bodily resurrection in the space and time right now. Other stuff that you can think of? Anything else? The primary languages of the Jewish people have somewhat shifted. Where it was Hebraic and Aramaic, primarily Hebraic back in the Old Testament, now it's going to be Greek and Aramaic, which is a big difference, major shift. So what you're noticing, though, is it's not just that we're connected to an old story or to a story that's greater than ours. It's that we have a lot that has shifted between Matthew and Malachi. To where if you don't know that 400-year period at all in between there, you really are coming into a whole new world. The gap between the Old and the New Testament becomes a lot larger in our Bibles because we don't have the Apocrypha. You just don't know the story. And that's one of the things we're going to try to piece together. There are four primary sources that we are going to be utilizing over the next 3 weeks. I won't be telling you every time I'm pulling from one. I will throw out some of the references as I go. But four primary sources to talk about the way in which the Jewish people have transformed in that 400 years. The first one you will be using throughout the New Testament gospel studies is the Old Testament. That's your primary source. However, by the time of the first century, the Old Testament now is developed into two linguistic traditions. You have the Masoretic text, the Hebrew Aramaic text of the Old Testament that we're all somewhat familiar with. I say somewhat because I've sat in our church pews and people still don't know the Old Testament very well, which is why Revelation is destroyed by them. But we'll talk about that later in another class and another time. But the second one is the Septuagint. Is now in full swing by the time of the Gospels. As a matter of fact, we get the Septuagint, the story of the Septuagint development, from two primary sources, and one of them is in the Old Testament pseudepigrapha, and that's these dogs right here. We'll talk about these more tomorrow. But here's your Old Testament pseudepigrapha, two volumes. This is the standard pseudepigrapha, James Charlesworth, those. But we get it from the book, The Letter of Aristeus, in the Old Testament pseudepigrapha. This would have been written around 130 to 70 BCE, but it's trying to act as if it were in the 3rd century BCE. So what you're doing is you have this guy named Aristeus, who is the eyewitness. He's an officer in the court of Ptolemy II, and he's in Alexandria, Egypt. And the problem that they found in Alexandria, Egypt, is that there's a large Jewish community, but the majority of them in Alexandria, Egypt, don't speak Aramaic or Hebrew anymore. They're not fluent. What they're fluent in primarily is Greek. And so Ptolemy II gives Aristeus the okay to have the Old Testament scriptures translated into Greek. And so then you have the Talmud that comes along and it says, so King Ptolemy once gathered 72 elders. He placed them in 72 chambers, each of them in a separate one, without revealing to them why they were summoned. He entered each one's room and said, write for me the Torah of Moshe, your teacher. God put it in the heart of each one to translate identically as all the others did. You ever wonder why Jesus, whenever, you know, in Luke's gospel, he sends out 72? It's because the idea was that there was a representative from every nation known on earth. And you have 72 elders that come here at this time. The number's not accidental. They come here to translate. Awesome. Power outage. This room's amazing. just keeps getting notched up on my list. So you have 72 people come from all the nations of the world. They come to translate, and lo and behold, they all get done, and it's the exact same. Now, you've heard the story before. The story is cute, but why is that translation of Septuagint important for New Testament studies? For gospel studies? Why is it important? Or is it? Maybe that's the initial question.
That they preach from most often?
What you find in the New Testament is a lot of the quotations usually are from the Septuagint. Now, not all the time, and you'd even be hard-pressed to argue for the vast majority, but a significant portion of the New Testament, when it is quoting, it's quoting from the Septuagint. One, matter of fact, you should ask yourself three questions when you come to any Old Testament quotation in the Gospels or in the New Testament. Three questions. Number one, does this come from the Septuagint or the Hebrew text? Does it come, or does it come from a different tradition altogether? Because sometimes we actually have some and it says, in Matthew's Gospel, it says, and as it is written, he will be called a Nazarene. We don't know where that's from. We don't know if it's Old Testament. We don't know if it's Septuagint. We don't know where it's coming from. Now, we've made some guesses at some combining some Old Testament texts. Nevertheless, we have no idea really what tradition he's pulling from there. So that's the first question you need to ask. What tradition is he pulling from? That's one of the... I won't get into that. The second question you need to ask, though, is how do the Septuagint and the Hebrew text differ at this quoted section? Linguistic question. How do they differ? What is the difference between them? And then the third question you need to ask is, do the differences between the Septuagint and the Hebrew text point to a different theological point? Or merely just insignificant linguistic differences? Because sometimes the whole direction of the Old Testament text is shifted between the Septuagint and the Masoretic text. That's just, yeah. So sometimes you have the New Testament authors opting for that for their theological purposes. So we have a major shift in really just the composition of the Old Testament itself from Malachi into the Gospel time period. The Septuagint is there. It's actually quite popular. And so you see a lot of overlap. The second source that we'll be using to construct the shifts of the Old Testament into the Gospel time period is the Apocrypha. Here's my little pocket version of the Apocrypha, the authorized version, in case you're wondering. You also will have it, like I've said, in the RSV, NRSV, they usually have them in there. You can Google it. It's very simple to get it. The Apocrypha, though, I'll go ahead and list all of the different... books, seriously. These are the different books of the Apocrypha, the traditional 15. The word Apocrypha literally means hidden away or hidden things. And just for your kind of, you know, food for thought or a trivia question, the word Apocrypha is actually plural. That's the plural form. The word Apocryphon is the singular form, in case you want to make sure that you're speaking accurately. Evans, though, describes why it even got this name in the book, in your textbook. And primarily, Evans says that a lot of times the people believe that these books were hidden away from the simpler minded, that these books were really reserved for the wise and the learned, and therefore they were known as the Apocrypha. We have used that word, we've transformed that word into kind of a pejorative term. You know, like, oh, is that story true or is it just an apocryphal story? We've almost associated Apocrypha or Apocryphal with false. And that's not the way the word was originally intended to be used. It was just meant it's hidden away from the simple-minded and reserved for the wise and learned. Really, that even probably comes from some anti-Catholic sentiments in our vernacular. Oh, it's an Apocryphal story. It's false. Oh, because the Apocrypha has nothing true to say. Okay. Yes?
Luther put it in his Bible. Mm-hmm.
You're darn right it's good to read. Jerome had it in the Vulgate. I mean, hello. It's not like that these things came out of nowhere. It's not like the Catholics just decided to go around one day and be like, what other books do we want to add in? No, I mean, it's not that foolish. What they were asking was, how can we make sure the people in the pews are not distorting Jesus? Ah, these 15 books really do help out a lot. Now notice there are some of these up here that are not in the Catholic Apocrypha primarily, although even though it is only in the Russian Orthodox canon, a lot of times when you pull up the Catholic Apocrypha, 2nd Esdras will pop up too. I want you to read 2nd Esdras. It is fantastic. We'll read a section of it tomorrow as well. Ecclesiasticus, you also need to know that it is called Sirach a lot of the time. If you don't want to make sure that you thinking those are different. And then you have the Prayer of Manasseh, which is only in the Greek Orthodox and Russian Orthodox canons. Matter of fact, the Greek Orthodox canon adds three more in addition to these 15. They add 3rd Maccabees, 4th Maccabees, and Psalm 151. And then the Russian Orthodox adds 3rd Maccabees in 151, Psalm 151, but they don't add 4th Maccabees. That's just whatever. But inside the Apocrypha, we have several different genres that are being utilized. You have, what I've done is I've cut it off the very bottom. That's 2nd Ezra, so that's all that's there, because that's the only really apocalyptic one. But you have the historical books, 1st Esdras, 1st Maccabees, 2nd Maccabees, the more romantic books, your love novels. Ladies, there's something in here for everyone, okay? You have, Tobit and Judith, Susanna, the additions to Esther, Wisdom or the didactic books, the Wisdom of Solomon. Sirach is huge. I'm just letting you know that right now. It is an enormous book. Don't save that one for last. You'll want to get that one out first, because this one's a beast. Very interesting things inside of Sirach. Moralistic books, Baruch, Epistle to Jeremiah, and I've already said this at the beginning, but I'll say it again. Sometimes Epistle to Jeremiah is the last chapter of Baruch, so sometimes those will be combined. Bela and the Dragon, that's actually, There's in addition to Daniel, that is what that would be referring to. Prayer of Azariah and the Song of the Three Children, Prayer of Manasseh, are devotional books, and the apocalyptic one is 2nd Esdras, and we will ask the question tomorrow morning, is the Apocrypha significant for New Testament studies? We'll give 3 examples how it impacts New Testament, and then we'll move to the pseudepigrapha. All right, love you guys. See you in the morning.